with me now is Elaine Chambers, who joined the Queen Alexandra's Royal Army Nursing Corps in 1982. Elaine, thank you so much for joining us to tell us your story.
Yeah, so I joined up in March 82 and I was a student nurse, so I was enlisting for 22 years, the first three of which would be my nurse training. So I did my training qualifying in July 1985. That therefore made me a staff nurse. And then just 15 months later, I'd applied for and successfully obtained a commission. So I became an officer, a lieutenant, and a junior sister. And at that point, my terms of engagement changed and potentially I was sort of ready for a long-term career, which would have taken me to the age of 55 in 2015.
So were you aware at the time of joining up that it was illegal to be gay in the military?
No, I didn't know that it was illegal. And in fact, I'd been led to believe by a soldier that I knew who, you know, he was very much in the know that the military would be a place where you might find quite a few gay women. And he was actually warning me how to avoid them, and I was like, oh yeah, thanks, okay. And then when I actually joined, when you enlisted in those days, I suppose it's equivalent nowadays of what you would call a contract, and you're given a notice of engagement, and it's four pages of A4, very small font, and you sign it, and I still have it, and I've scoured it so many times over the years to make sure I wasn't just wishfully thinking that it doesn't mention anything at all. And it doesn't. There's nothing about homosexuality and there's nothing even about pregnancy. And, you know, lots of women were thrown out for that. So, no, there was no reason to believe that it was illegal. But I found out very quickly after I joined that it wasn't just illegal, but effectively it deems you a criminal if you even thought you might be gay, never mind acted upon those feelings.
So how did you find out that homosexual relationships weren't allowed in the military and the consequences of that? Because you kind of go through this a little bit in the documentary.
Well, it was a very difficult situation, but a wonderful situation in that I very shortly after I joined up and during basic training became involved with a fellow recruit. And that was very difficult because it was brilliant and wonderful and made me realise that all of my sort of teenage angst was misplaced in terms of feeling right and happy about who I might have been and who I was. But then immediately being made aware, particularly by her, we've got to be careful. You do know this isn't allowed, don't you? And I was like, oh, okay. I hadn't really realised, but she was much more savvy than I was and recognised that it was very, very dangerous and it had to be kept a secret. And so that was really difficult because on the one hand, I was just so relieved and felt, oh, my God, this feels so right and so normal and natural for me that I wanted to kind of sing it from the rooftops and let people know how happy I was. But then that was obviously completely not allowed, and I had to, you know, hide everything I was feeling, and that was really tough.
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? It must be so difficult to find out who you are and then having to keep that a secret. So how did you feel when you found that out and that you were protecting the country's peace and freedom, but you were being denied those very things?
I didn't kind of fully realise that at the time, but certainly with the wisdom of hindsight, the irony is delicious, isn't it? You've got people who aren't even conscripted, who are voluntarily signing the line to potentially put their lives at risk for the rest of the nation, to protect everybody else's rights and freedoms to be themselves. And yet you yourself are not allowed those self-same rights. I mean, it sounds ridiculous to even say it, and I've often felt that since. You know, I look back and think, good grief, you know, how did I not even kind of realise that at the time? But I was just so taken up with the excitement of feeling that I was sort of in love, and also just with the actual life I was living. You know, the nurse training was absolutely fantastic. The military hospitals were really well staffed, and I just loved the training. And I was meeting people that, you know, you often hear people probably think, oh, God, there they go again, talking about camaraderie, this famous military family camaraderie. But unless you've lived through it, it is absolutely true. It's not an exaggeration. And I'm still in touch with people now, all those years later, more than 40 years later, because You know, this was a pre-social media era and we were out in Cold War Germany. So when anything went wrong, when there were problems, we had to be each other's family because you couldn't even phone your own folks at home easily because that would be ringing from a sort of public phone box on the wall with everybody listening and, you know, pumping in five Deutschmark pieces. So, you know, you really do love and support one another like a family. So I was living the best life. It was just absolutely fantastic.
If you don't mind me asking, you know, you were serving in Hanover and this is when the allegations were made against you. Can you perhaps tell us a little bit about what they were?
Yeah, so basically I'd been out to Germany as a student nurse in Rintown, and then I had the good fortune, or the bad fortune, if you look back again with the wisdom of hindsight, fate led me to swapping from Catterick to Hanover. And I went out there and I was a junior sister, as I say. I was so a second in charge of the family's ward. I was a unit sports officer. Again, living a very good life. And, you know, I was adapting well to being an officer because I was a bit nervous about that change, that transition from the ranks. And it was working incredibly well. I was basically getting ready to pursue a longer term career. I'd made up my mind that I wanted to move into midwifery and do midwifery training. And in a way, it was those kind of links that led to fate being unkind, in that basically it all kicked off from a rumour. And it was a very small hospital, like a lot of the military hospitals were. A lot of people knew each other's business. And somebody was basically supposing about another QA officer that some terrible experiences she'd been through might lead to her having lesbian tendencies. And the person who was, this conversation was being addressed to, said to the other person, who was a senior officer but also a lesbian, and everyone knew she was a lesbian, nobody cared, and they made the mistake of saying to her, oh no, if anyone in the mess has lesbian tendencies, then it's Elaine. And that was it. And basically what happened was, because of that, this senior closeted lesbian officer starts, she was like a terrier with a rag and wouldn't let go, because I suppose she was trying to kind of keep her straight credentials in order. So she basically is saying to this other person, what do you mean? You can't say things like that. Do you realise how serious this is? It's not allowed. It's not allowed. And so this person, with whom I'd had a very brief sort of, I don't know what you'd call it really, but it's a very old-fashioned term, but I used the term in the past, necking session, completely mutually and voluntarily and, you know, nobody's business, and it happened some weeks before and been pretty much forgotten about. Can't say that's how she knows, because if she says that, then she is going to be tainted with the same sapphic brush that I've been tainted with. And as I said, being anything other than heteronormative was basically viewed as a crime and deemed you therefore a criminal, literally. So she immediately panicked and made out that I'd made a move on her, an unwanted move, and that she'd sort of shoved me off and told me to be careful, you know, you're not allowed to do that. And I never fully understood how it happened, but basically another friend of theirs kind of came into the fray, and the pair of them, between them, you know, cooked up these stories that I'd made unwanted moves on them. So I was basically summoned to Matron's office, who then called the Special Investigation Branch of the Royal Military Police, and an investigation began. And when I was handed my notice to suspect, I was basically told that what the allegations were indecent assault on a female aged 16 or over. It was horrific. It was so terrifying.
I mean, it just sounds absolutely awful. I've got no words to describe it, to be honest with you. And what's so sad is that, you know, you spoke earlier about your work and your friends, and it sounded such a positive experience. And then for that to happen to you and to go through that. But how did the investigation affect you? Because that can't have been easy on your mental health.
No, it was horrendous. I knew that my career was over immediately. And when they came and searched my room and then took away all my private letters and diaries and books and all sorts of things, I thought, oh God, you know, they've got enough proof there that I have what they deem to be proclivities or unnatural desires, which always made me very cross because it felt quite natural to me. But basically, I knew my career was over. So I was fighting to save myself from these hideous allegations, because the reality is, if I had been taken to court-martial and found guilty, I could have been struck off the nursing register, which was my, you know, my career, my profession. So, but I became very quickly aware that once they'd realised that these allegations were never going to make it to charges, for two reasons. One, because the other person with whom I'd been very briefly involved actually sadly had a complete nervous breakdown, but confessed that she'd lied and that my version of events was the wholly true version. And that, you know, thankfully for me, that saved me, I suppose. But what happened on the second lot of questioning was that the original allegations were pretty much put to one side, and it was all, oh, we've got letters here, you know, you've written to so-and-so about this, and so-and-so in this letter, 2.5-year-old letter, talking about somebody and suggest they might have the same unnatural proclivities as you. What do you think? And I was sort of thinking, what does it matter what I think? I thought you were investigating whether I'd assaulted somebody or not. What are you talking about? I'm not going to tell you what I think. And it led to people around the world being investigated that were nothing to do with my case and losing their careers because of my letters and diaries, which was an enormous... the guilt and the stress was phenomenally difficult to deal with. And it was the lowest ebb I've ever been at. And it's the only time in my entire life I was very, very close to contemplating suicide. And it was only someone knocking on my door when I was incredibly drunk and about to take a load of temazepam that saved my life. So, yes, it was horrific.
I am so sorry that you had to go through that. I mean, the work that you did with the military itself is an incredible thing that you've done. And the charges were dropped or disproved, but you were forced to resign. So how was it upon learning that? Because you decided to take a stand and you co-founded the activist and support group Rank Outsiders and found others in similar positions.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, my being an officer was kind of good from the point of view that although it was a Hobson's choice of you must resign or we'll make you resign anyway. So I thought, oh, OK, I'll resign. So I resigned my commission in January 88. But in a way, that's good because it means you can make up whatever story you like when you're looking for new employment, you know, to the point of saying, oh, I much preferred it in the ranks. I didn't like it as an officer. I never did that, but there were options if I wished to. And so because I was basically being forced out, thrown out, I thought maybe it's time I came out. You know, because at the time of my investigation, I was still seeing men and trying to be straight and trying to fit in and convince myself that what I felt was a phase or a crush or I was bisexual, anything to not be this most vilified and hated of people, a gay woman. So I was very lucky as well. You know, so many other veterans were abandoned by their families, found themselves homeless, but I didn't. My mum and dad stood by me. So I went back to the family home in Harrow and was very lucky, really, because I started to come out and the scene in the early 90s was really good. And I finally plucked up courage. One week the topic was coming out at the Gays the Word Lesbian discussion group. And I thought, coming out, OK. And I went along and it was absolutely incredible to meet this wide range of wonderful women of all hues who were just content and happy with being themselves. And that was just an absolute revelation in itself. So that began a wonderful sort of period of time in my life. And I was lucky enough to meet Robert Ely because he'd done an article. There was a little interview in the Pink Paper and it was about him. And he'd been forced out after 19 years. He was a bandmaster with the Parachute Regiment. He joined as a boy soldier in 1966 before the Woolford Act had even partially decriminalised homosexuality for the rest of the country. And, it had a phone number because he wanted other people to contact him because he was trying to gather evidence because he'd been asked to testify at the five-yearly Armed Forces Select Committee at the Houses of Parliament. And that was really wonderful, basically, because we got in touch. It was the first time either of us had really spoken to anybody else at any length who understood what it was about, but also to realise that you weren't the only one. And so we got together and we were lucky enough to take part in a documentary, Heart of the Matter, with Joan Bakewell. And that went out prime time on BBC, and that got massive interest. So we set up a membership organisation of Rank Outsiders.
It's great to hear that you were able to form this group, Rank Outsiders, and it played such a huge role in overturning this injustice. So how did you feel in 2000 when the ban was overturned? Do you remember those feelings? And what's life like for you now?
It was wonderful. It was well overdue, but good to recognise that it happened and the world didn't implode and the rank and file didn't leave in their droves, as had been predicted by the naysayers for years on numerous debate programmes. But it was a double-edged sword for me because I couldn't rejoin, because you could only join the QAs between the ages of 18 and 38, and I'd just turned 39. Mixed feelings. And I think the important thing to say is that, you know, the reason I maybe don't sound as excited about it as I should have done was the fact that I think for many people that was it. They thought, well, Rank Outsiders, you did your bit. And then, you know, the Armed Forces Legal Challenge Group set up by one of our members, Ed Hall, which led the actual way to the ban being lifted. We were sort of, in our own strange way, we were SNLR, services no longer required. And there was this idea that everyone kind of was skipping off into the rainbow coloured sunset and job done, isn't that marvellous? Whereas for many of us who were part of that legal challenge, the legal challenge didn't end until 2009. So it was hard to be very happy about it because we were still battling the Ministry of Defence and the Treasury solicitor for a fair resolution to our complaints, and it never happened. So at the end of it, that had been 14 years of legal battle with not a great outcome. But, you know, to now, I suppose part of me feels fantastic when I meet young LGBT serving personnel, which I've done on occasions, you know, when I march with things like Royal British Legion, I've marched a couple of times on prides, and seeing people who are joining now who actually go, oh, I didn't even know there was a ban. And that for me it's mixed feelings, because I'm chuffed for them. That's just absolutely brilliant, and it's probably as it should be. But there is a part of me thinks, you need to know about this. This is important history, and you need to know, not least, to make sure it never happens again.
Elaine, thank you so much for joining us on BFBS, the Forces Station. I really appreciate you sharing your story with us, and we look forward to watching this documentary on Sky where you tell your story.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
BFBS, the Forces Station.